Hi, listeners. It's Carter, here to tell you about an incredible event celebrating the launch of Parcast's first book, Cults. On July 13th, crime junkies Ashley Flowers and Parcast founder Max Cutler are coming together for a night of true crime to remember. And you can be part of it virtually on Spotify Live or in person. The evening will take place in Los Angeles and feature discussions about the book, a live Q&A, and so much more. All ticket sales up to $125,000 will be matched by Max Cutler and donated to Season of Justice, a nonprofit founded by Ashley Flowers that provides financial resources to help solve cold cases and support families impacted by unsolved violent crimes. It's a wonderful cause and an evening perfect for any true crime fan. But time is running out. Register for your spot today at parcast.com/cults. All attendees will receive a special signed copy of Parcast's new book, Cults. So don't wait. Sign up at parcast.com/cults.
Due to the graphic nature of this woman's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of warfare and attempted suicide. We advise extreme caution for children under the age of 13. There's an Abraham Lincoln quote that goes, "Be sure you put your feet in the right place, then stand firm." And whether or not Chelsea Manning was a big fan of Honest Abe, that's certainly what she did. When she teamed up with WikiLeaks, she changed the world. By leaking hundreds of thousands of classified documents, she shed light on what was really happening in Iraq and Afghanistan. She believed the world deserved to know the truth. Her actions paved the way for future whistleblowers to follow in her footsteps and expose the secrets they were privy to. Without her, there might not be an Edward Snowden or reality winner. Unfortunately, changing the world is never easy, and it always comes at a cost. Welcome to Female Criminals, a Spotify original from Parcast. History has seen its fair share of women in trouble with the law, but whether or not they were all criminals is sometimes open to interpretation. This is the show where we cover the full spectrum of women behaving badly. Last week, we met Chelsea Manning as she enlisted in the Army, hoping to find herself. But instead, she became disillusioned with the war and felt that the public needed to know the truth. Then we followed along as she sent her first classified documents to WikiLeaks. This week, we'll explore how Chelsea escalated her espionage. Then we'll dive into the world-shattering aftermath, including the mistake that led to her arrest and her horrifying prison sentence. We've got all that and more coming up. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
A new true crime podcast from the team behind Up and Vanished. In 2016, adventurer Justin Alexander was invited on a trek by an Indian holy man. They headed to a spiritual ground in the Himalayan mountains, a place beyond civilization. The holy man returned and said nothing, but Justin was never seen again. What happened to him? Dive into our investigation in Status Untraced. Available now. Listen for free on Spotify.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
In January of 2010, 22-year-old Chelsea Manning was staring down the barrel of a life-changing decision. Days earlier, she'd sent WikiLeaks an encrypted file of a U.S. airstrike on the Afghanistan town of Granai. She wanted people in the States to see that they weren't getting the full story about the wars in the Middle East. Now, Chelsea had to decide, would she be one and done, or did she want to leak more than the Granai video? The trouble was, WikiLeaks hadn't actually done anything with the video yet. They confirmed they had it in their possession, but they couldn't decrypt the file, so it never aired anywhere. But Chelsea knew that Granai wasn't a one-off. It was just a drop in the freaking ocean. There were mountains of troubling footage on the database, and pretty much anyone with basic security clearance had access to it all. The military might have wanted to keep these recordings secret from the public, but they didn't care if their soldiers saw them. In fact, they actually used the videos for training purposes. That's how Chelsea saw the Apache helicopter recording for the first time. While she worked at her desk, a fellow soldier pulled up the tape and hit play. Chelsea watched in horror as the events unfolded on the screen. In the aerial footage taken in July of 2007, an Apache attack helicopter circled a suburb of Baghdad. There'd been a firefight in the area, and the Americans were called in as reinforcements. Soon, the two-person crew aboard the Apache located a group of men who appeared to be carrying weapons. The soldiers requested permission to engage, and when that came through, they rained bullets into the streets. The men on the ground scattered, fleeing for their lives. A few moments later, the gunfire stopped and the dust settled. The camera mounted on the Apache captured footage of bodies strewn across the street. The American pilot watched as one man tried to crawl to safety. He wanted to fire again, but he needed a reason. Under the rules of engagement, it's illegal to kill a combatant who has surrendered or is no longer a threat. The pilot explained to his colleague that all the man needed to do was pick up a weapon. Then, essentially, he'd be fair game. Sure enough, the man crawling on the ground had an object in his arms. The pilot and his fellow soldier leaned forward to get a closer look. To them, it looked like a rocket-propelled grenade launcher or an RPG, the kind that can take out a helicopter. So they fired. A moment later, an unmarked van screeched onto the scene. The soldiers aboard the Apache believed it was bringing more hostile enemies, so they once again got permission to open fire. Until finally, there was no one left moving. When ground forces arrived shortly after, they searched the van. But instead of hostile combatants, they found a 43-year-old man dead in the driver's seat of the van. His 10-year-old son and 5-year-old daughter were seriously wounded in the back. They'd been on their way to school when their dad saw the man crawling on the ground and stopped to help. Oh, and the man they'd stopped to help? He was Reuters journalist Saeed Chama, and the object he'd been carrying was a long-lens camera, not an RPG. Thankfully, the kids survived their injuries. Sadly, the rest of the men weren't so lucky. Saeed Chama, his fellow journalist Namir Nour el-Din, and 9 other men died. The video made Chelsea sick. The way she saw it, the pilots had slaughtered an innocent group of civilians. She wanted to know more about the mission. She needed to make sense of what happened. A quick Google search told her that Reuters wanted the video. They'd applied for it under the Freedom of Information Act years back, but the U.S. government insisted it was classified material. And Chelsea knew why. Nothing in the footage posed a threat to future missions or intelligence. The U.S. military simply didn't want to acknowledge its mistake. Chelsea found that idea unacceptable. They needed to be held accountable. Before we continue with Chelsea's psychology, please keep in mind that I'm not a licensed psychiatrist or psychologist, but we have done a lot of research for the show. According to psychologist Steven Pinker, moral judgments hold a lot more sway than our general opinions. For example, we can believe with our whole hearts that asparagus is a disgusting vegetable. That's an opinion. So when someone else eats asparagus, we don't think they're a terrible person, right? However, when it comes to moral beliefs, they're much stronger. Those are our tentpole beliefs, and we feel that they're universal, whether that's true or not. But unlike with general opinions like which vegetables are worst, we do judge people who don't uphold our moral beliefs. If we believe that killing is wrong, then anyone who kills another human being isn't just wrong, they're evil. Pinker explains that this is because moralization is a psychological state with a distinctive mindset that commandeers our thinking. He likens it to a switch that can be turned on and off. When it's on, it makes us deem actions immoral rather than merely disagreeable, unfashionable, or imprudent. When morality is involved, we become more extreme. And a hallmark of moralization is the belief that anyone who commits immoral acts deserves to be punished. After watching the Reuters video, that's how Chelsea felt. There were people at the top who needed to be held accountable. They were keeping too many secrets simply because it served them. It wasn't right. But the more Chelsea thought about it, the more she realized that one document or video wasn't going to cut it. She didn't want to just shed light on one horrific mission. She wanted to expose them all. So on January 5th, 2010, Chelsea began downloading hundreds of thousands of SIG acts, or significant action reports, from the military's databases. She wasn't exactly sure what she would do with all the intelligence, but she loaded it all onto her personal computer anyway. She had a 2-week leave coming up, and she wanted the documents at the ready. Later that month, Chelsea flew to Washington, D.C. for her leave and weighed her options. She'd done a huge, scary thing, but there was still a chance to turn back. She could return to Iraq with the sensitive materials, erase them from her computer, and no one would have to know. But if she chose to move forward, she risked her entire livelihood. Getting caught would mean, at best, dishonorable discharge from the army and the loss of everything that went along with that. Her pay, pension, the college education, future job prospects. At worst, she'd end up in prison, locked away with war criminals and traitors. All of this weighed heavy on Chelsea's mind, but it seemed that she was done keeping secrets. All of them. That same trip, Chelsea took a night off from debating her future. She donned a dress and a long blonde wig, then headed out into public. According to author Denver Nix, she picked up all her favorite things: cigarettes, McDonald's, Starbucks. Then she took the train from D.C. to Boston to visit some friends. According to Chelsea, she was entirely at ease. There were a few hiccups along the way, like when she had to pull out her driver's license, but all in all, it felt right. This was the person she was meant to be. That night meant everything to Chelsea. It was the first time she'd truly stepped out into the world as a woman, and it felt good. She knew she'd have to go back to hiding her true self while deployed, but for the first time, she saw a future where she could one day be herself. Personally, I like to think that this experience played a role in her decision about what to do next. In her heart, Chelsea had always known who she was. Sometimes she just had to be reminded of it. And deep down, Chelsea was someone who stood up for what was right. When she saw something wrong, she said something. So she did. At this stage, Chelsea's first thought wasn't to go to WikiLeaks. After the poor handling of the Granai video, she worried that their site was a black hole for submissions. An established news organization, on the other hand, had the experience and resources to handle such a story. For Chelsea, there were two places at the top of her list: the New York Times and the Washington Post. Chelsea went to a public phone and called the Times first, but the best she got there was a voicemail for the public editor. No good. Next up, she tried the Post and spoke to an actual human. Chelsea gave the journalist a vague explanation of what she had, but refused to identify herself or show the writer the files. Chelsea wanted a commitment that they'd publish what she had. Only then would she hand it over. Unfortunately, the Post journalist told her she needed more concrete details before she could bring the story to her editor, but that wasn't an option.
Ironically, Chelsea was worried about her identity getting leaked. So Chelsea moved on to her third choice, Politico. She managed to get a meeting with them, which seemed promising, until the meeting got canceled due to the weather. Chelsea was running out of time. She only had a couple days left of her leave, and she couldn't see a way to establish contact with these major outlets without sacrificing her anonymity as the source. But there was one place where she could remain anonymous. It wasn't as prestigious or legit, but it was the only viable option at this point, and Chelsea wasn't going to let anything get in the way of her mission. So she gave WikiLeaks one last chance to redeem itself. On February 3, 2010, she sent all the files to them, along with a message that read, "This is possibly one of the more significant documents of our time, removing the fog of war and revealing the true nature of 21st century asymmetric warfare. Have a good day." And with that, 22-year-old Chelsea became the biggest whistleblower in American history. Coming up, Chelsea makes a critical mistake.
Hi, listeners. It's Carter with some truly exciting news. To commemorate the launch of Cults, Parcast's first book, Crime Junkies Ashley Flowers and Parcast founder Max Cutler are coming together on July 13th for an in-person and virtual experience you do not want to miss. The evening will take place in Los Angeles and feature a live Q&A about the book, an exclusive meet and greet, and a discussion on all things true crime. All ticket sales up to $125,000 will be matched by Max Cutler and donated to Season of Justice, a nonprofit founded by Ashley that provides funding to law enforcement agencies and families to help solve cold cases. It's an amazing organization near and dear to both Ashley and Max, and another great reason to enjoy this wonderful night. And it's just days away, so visit parcast.com/cults to register today. You can also catch the event virtually on Spotify Live if you were unable to join us in person. All attendees will get a signed copy of the book and a night they'll never forget. July 13th is fast approaching, so be sure to join Ashley Flowers and Max Cutler for a very special evening celebrating the release of Parcast's new book, Cults, all for an incredible cause. Register today at parcast.com/cults.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
Now back to the story. According to the New York Times, in February of 2010, 22-year-old Chelsea Manning returned to her station in Iraq, where everything was business as usual. WikiLeaks had made no indication that they'd received her documents, and no one on the base had any idea what she'd done. It was a waiting game, an incredibly stressful one. Chelsea could barely sleep or eat. To cope with the constant state of paranoia, she smoked even more than usual, and every day she looked online to see if WikiLeaks had posted anything. But every day, nothing. However, by mid-February, there was another political scenario unfolding, one that Chelsea had insider information about. This is a bit of a detour, but stick with me. You see, Iceland was in an ongoing financial crisis at the time. Essentially, an Icelandic bank had failed, and now the country owed the Netherlands and Britain money. It erupted into a big dispute over the repayment process. Apparently, Iceland had turned to the US to quietly ask for help. Chelsea knew this because she had access to the diplomatic cables, and from those, it was clear that the US was not going to step in. But Chelsea thought they should. She saw the U.S. as a bully who refused to help the little guy, and she figured if she leaked messages showing the government's disdain toward Iceland, maybe she could help drum up enough public pressure to right a wrong. On February 18th, she sent those cables to WikiLeaks. And this time? Well, they posted the cables within a matter of hours under the title Reykjavik 13. The post didn't cause many waves in the public zeitgeist. There was nothing flashy about it, certainly nothing that would make for a great headline or tantalizing clickbait on the internet. But for Chelsea, the sheer fact that it was published meant everything. It was evidence that WikiLeaks had received her documents. Surely that meant they'd soon post the treasure trove of classified intel she'd shared with them weeks earlier. They were probably just taking their time sorting through it all. Spurred on by this knowledge, Chelsea followed up that same day with another leak that simply couldn't be ignored. The video of the Apache helicopter killing two Reuters journalists. It's unclear whether she deliberately held that recording back from her massive file dump or if it had been an oversight. But either way, she wanted to get it out now. That was at the end of February. WikiLeaks didn't publish the footage until April 5th. But when they did, it made a splash. The video that WikiLeaks eventually released was edited from the raw footage Chelsea sent. Their version was 18 minutes long and was titled Collateral Murder. Nearly every major news outlet picked up the story and ran with it. And it set off a firestorm of controversy. Some people praised the leak for exposing the cruelty of war and even went as far as to call the video evidence of war crimes. But not everyone was supportive of the leak. In fact, the vast majority of mainstream media condemned the handling of the video. Many argue that the title Collateral Murder and the way the video was edited was purely for maximum emotional manipulation. There was also criticism that the video didn't show the whole picture. The Apache pilots had been on high alert due to recent gunfights in the area, and two of the men who were killed that day had been carrying weapons. One had an AK-47, and the other had an RPG. The Reuters journalists were a tragic casualty, but it wasn't the soldiers' fault. Still, no matter what way you sliced it, it was hard to watch that video and not feel like the soldiers were out for blood. In short, the release of that recording accomplished exactly what Chelsea had wanted. It led to debates about war tactics and questions about the U.S. military's classified protocols. As far as Chelsea was concerned, it was a success and a reason to keep going. Next up, she logged into the NetCentric Diplomacy database, which held all diplomatic cables from the previous 50 years. For a week and a half in early April, while working at her SCIF workstation, Chelsea downloaded State Department messaging spanning from 1966 to 2010. In total, it was more than 250,000 records. When they were eventually released, they earned the name Cablegate. At this point, Chelsea was committed to her cause. Unlike whistleblowers before her, she wasn't out to expose a single event. She wanted to remove all the veils of secrecy. And doing that meant divulging troves of information, regardless of whether it was interesting or not. Following in that spirit of transparency, Chelsea was eager to tell someone what she'd done. She was proud of her actions, but more importantly, she didn't want to feel so alone. According to Columbia Business School professor Michael Slepian, keeping secrets can be exhausting. This is in part because it alienates us from others. There's a fundamental human need to connect with people, but when we're holding secrets, we put up walls that make relationships difficult. But Professor Slepian argues there's a simple solution: sharing the secret. His research shows that confiding a secret improved well-being both because the person received social support and because the act of revealing the secret seemed to minimize the amount of time the person spent thinking about it. Whether consciously or not, Chelsea understood this. She needed to get this massive secret off her chest, otherwise she was going to burst. But rather than publicly confess her crimes, Chelsea went to where she felt the most comfortable, the internet. Online, she got in touch with 29-year-old hacker Adrian Lamo. LaMo was well known not just for hacking into massive corporations like AOL and Yahoo, but for telling them what he'd done so they could fix their security flaws. He was a renegade, a maverick, someone who stuck it to the man, but only because he was trying to do the right thing, protecting people's privacy. For that reason, LaMo was a controversial figure in the hacking world. But that's also what made Chelsea think he would understand her need to divulge secrets to help the public. Chelsea instant messaged LaMo on May 21st, introducing herself as an Army intelligence officer. Then she posed the question, if you had unprecedented access to classified networks 14 hours a day, 7 days a week for 8+ months, what would you do? Chelsea hit send and waited. Until finally, LaMo responded. From there, Chelsea tiptoed around the details of what she'd done. LaMo told Chelsea that he was technically both a journalist and a minister, so she could feel safe talking to him off the record. And so she did. Through their online chat, Chelsea confessed everything. She trusted LaMo because he said he believed in WikiLeaks' mission. But when push came to shove, it turned out LaMo didn't buy into the idea of total transparency. The more Chelsea divulged, the more uneasy he got, and he wondered whether he should do something about it. He didn't want to turn her in. He thought she was just an innocent kid trying to do the right thing. But what she'd done was irresponsible. Who knew what secrets were in the hundreds of thousands of documents and cables she'd sent to WikiLeaks? LaMo worried that people's lives were in danger, so he started making some calls. Meanwhile, Chelsea had no idea that LaMo had turned on her. All she knew was that she felt a million times better after unloading her secret, and she wanted to keep that going. So she made a monumental decision. She emailed her superior a photo of herself in the blonde wig she'd worn during her leave. She titled the email, My Problem. Chelsea told them that she wanted people to know the truth, no matter the consequences. She was a transgender woman. She hit send and let out a sigh of relief. But while her captain confirmed receipt of the email, it seemed he swept it under the rug. It was easier to pretend Chelsea hadn't told him anything than to deal with a potential scandal. Chelsea was stunned. She'd anticipated punishments, a discharge, something. It wasn't that she wanted trouble, but she was done hiding. She longed for the world to know who she truly was. But even when she announced it loud and clear, no one heard her. So, like she'd done with the escalating leaks, when she didn't get the response she wanted, she tried something bigger. Chelsea says that after this, she decided to go public as a whistleblower. She just had to figure out the best way to do it. Even if that was true, the decision to unmask herself had already been made for her. LaMo had tipped off the Army Criminal Investigation Division, who were on their way to question Chelsea. On May 26th, two agents arrived at Forward Operating Base Hammer. They pulled Chelsea into a conference room and interrogated her about the leaked classified intel. Suddenly confronted with the consequences of her actions, Chelsea didn't feel so great about coming clean. She denied everything. Not that it made a difference. The agents arrested her and led her to a waiting helicopter bound for a detention center in Kuwait. They charged her with 22 violations of the Espionage Act, including aiding the enemy, or in other words, treason. It was a crime that, if the 22-year-old were found guilty, could be punishable by death. Coming up, Chelsea fights for her life. Now back to the story. In May of 2010, 22-year-old Chelsea Manning was thrown into a cramped cell in Kuwait, where her only human contact was her guards. As the isolation settled in, Chelsea desperately clung to her truth. She was a woman who'd done the right thing. She knew she had to deny her role in the leaks, but she'd already told a superior that she was a transgender woman, so she figured she might as well be honest about that with her guards. But they laughed in her face. She hadn't expected them to welcome her with open arms, but she'd hoped for some common decency. As the days went by, Chelsea was consumed with rage and sadness, and any little thing set her off. If a guard made an offhand comment about her gender, it sent her into a fit of uncontrollable screaming, shaking, and babbling, and she'd bang her head against her cell walls. After a week of this, Chelsea was desperate to get her superior's attention. She told New York Times journalist Matthew Scher that she contemplated suicide and went through the motions, but in her own words, it was a half-hearted attempt. She knew she wouldn't succeed, but that wasn't the point. She just wanted someone to help her. Eventually, the officers brought in a doctor who examined Chelsea and diagnosed her with anxiety, depression, and gender dysphoria. Unfortunately, there wasn't much the doctor could do at that point besides prescribe an antidepressant. For Chelsea, it all felt hopeless, like she'd hit the end of the road. But while Chelsea was locked away, the outside world learned her name. On June 10th, Wired journalists Kevin Polson and Kim Zetter published the chat logs between Chelsea and Adrian Lamo, the hacker who turned her in. Readers pored over the messages, and curiosity piqued. What exactly had Chelsea Manning sent to WikiLeaks? Everyone wanted to know. But WikiLeaks couldn't just dump the intel. They had hundreds of thousands of diplomatic cables, classified documents, and videos to sift through. Even for a site that called for radical transparency, they still had to verify the documents and redact certain names for safety. And that took time. To help sort through the mass of information, WikiLeaks partnered with the New York Times, The Guardian, and German newspaper Der Spiegel. The papers prepared articles that focused on the bombshell revelations, like unreported civilian casualties, as well as evidence of collusion between Pakistani intelligence and the Taliban. Meanwhile, WikiLeaks went about uploading the entirety of the files to their site. The established newspapers would get the everyday citizens' attention. Then WikiLeaks would show the receipts. On July 25, 2010, WikiLeaks and its press partners published what they called the Afghan War Logs. The Iraq War Logs would soon follow. It was the largest publication of classified information ever disclosed in one fell swoop, and every single piece of information came from Chelsea Manning. Those leaked documents showed that the wars were not going as well as the U.S. government made it seem. In fact, there was a full-scale humanitarian disaster waging in the Middle East. Additionally, the evidence showed that American forces were responsible for over 10,000 more civilian deaths than they had officially acknowledged. To put it lightly, it was a PR nightmare. After the Afghan war logs dropped, the military transferred Chelsea to Quantico Marine Base in Virginia. Supposedly, this was so that they could provide her with better facilities for her fragile state. But the truth was that Quantico was worse than Kuwait. Chelsea spent 23 hours a day in a 6x8-foot cell under suicide watch. She was forced to wear a smock designed to be impossible to twist or rip off. The guards also took away her sheets and pillows, so she had nothing to sleep on but a hard cot. On top of that, she was regularly strip-searched, confined in solitary, and deprived of exercise. They even took away her glasses so she couldn't read. According to a report filed later by a UN special rapporteur, the conditions were so bad that they could have qualified as, quote, torture. And yet, this was the way Chelsea lived for the next 2 years while she awaited her military trial. One day bleeding into the next, with nothing ever getting better. A cynical person might call the conditions punitive, but I would never. Finally, in June of 2013, it was time for 25-year-old Chelsea's hearing. The entire world awaited with bated breath for the results. Journalists flooded the gallery, and overflow extended to outside the courthouse. Citizens refreshed news sites and Twitter at home, waiting for updates. After all, Chelsea Manning had changed the world. Some people credited her leaks with inspiring the series of anti-government uprisings and protests known as the Arab Springs, and they almost certainly prevented President Obama from extending the U.S. military's time in Iraq. Of course, there were people on the other side, those who argued that Chelsea's actions endangered thousands of lives. It seemed like everyone had an opinion on the case and wanted it to go their way. But for Chelsea, sitting at the defense table, it was a matter of life and death. She was there with her lawyers, who had one goal: prevent her from getting the death penalty. Both sides argued their points, and then they waited. As if orchestrated for maximum cinematic effect, just 2 days into Chelsea's trial, Edward Snowden leaked 1.5 million documents about the NSA spying on Americans. Not only was it a massive story, but it was also proof that Chelsea had paved the way for more whistleblowers. The government already wanted to see her punished, but that pressure to make an example out of her must have skyrocketed. They wanted to make it clear: leaking would have consequences. Ultimately, the judge went the government's way. He found Chelsea guilty on all but the two most serious counts. She wasn't convicted of aiding the enemy, which meant the death penalty was off the table, but she still got 35 years, which was the longest punishment ever handed down to a whistleblower in U.S. history. But her story wasn't over yet. During her trial, Chelsea hadn't made her gender identity public. She didn't want to complicate an already complex case. But after that, she was done pretending. If she was going to be in prison for the next 3+ decades, she wanted to at least be herself. So in August of 2013, Chelsea wrote a statement. Her lawyer brought her letter on the Today Show, where Savannah Guthrie read Chelsea's words to the world. "As I transition into the next phase of my life, I want everyone to know the real me. I am Chelsea Manning. I am female." It was a watershed moment, but at the exact time the statement was being read on national TV, Chelsea was stuck on a plane on her way to the United States Disciplinary Barracks at Fort Leavenworth, a maximum security facility reserved for the worst military prisoners. Unfortunately for Chelsea, officials at Fort Leavenworth didn't respect her gender identity. While the outside world came to know her as Chelsea Manning, inside the prison walls, she was still forced to abide by male army standards. That meant keeping her hair short, wearing a certain type of briefs, everything. Chelsea was distraught. It was a cruel twist of fate that right as she had publicly embraced being a woman, she was forced into the least conducive environment for her identity. But she wasn't going to just accept the situation. She knew it was a long shot, but Chelsea asked the prison officials for estrogen and anti-androgen drugs. She wanted to start her transition, but the army refused. Hormone therapy wasn't sanctioned for soldiers, let alone prisoners. The best she could get was antidepressants and time with a psychotherapist. It wasn't enough, so Chelsea's team filed a lawsuit against the Department of Defense. They brought in a psychologist to evaluate Chelsea, who found that she was, quote, experiencing significant distress and was at high risk for serious medical consequences, including self-castration and suicide. This isn't uncommon when it comes to incarcerated trans people. According to Dr. Lori Kohler, an expert on medical management of transgender prisoners, suicide, depression, and self-castration are all possible outcomes when an inmate is denied hormone therapy. That might sound drastic, but Dr. Kohler explains that in the eyes of the trans prisoners she treats, it's not an act of self-mutilation. Rather, quote, they feel like they're righting a wrong. For many activists, the idea that someone like Chelsea could be denied hormone therapy was akin to cruel and unusual punishment. Anywhere else, hormone therapy was legal medical treatment. But the military wasn't bound to the same laws as the rest of us, and it's possible that Chelsea was the first military prisoner to request gender-reaffirming hormones. There was no precedent, and they weren't going to budge, not unless someone forced them to. Well, in early 2015, that's exactly what happened. A ruling came down that ordered the military to grant Chelsea's request. For the first time, an inmate in a military prison received health care related to gender transition. It was a monumental breakthrough. But that didn't mean it was all smooth sailing after that. Transitioning can be tough under any circumstances, let alone while behind bars. Chelsea welcomed the physical changes, but she struggled to balance her emotions as her testosterone levels dipped. As the estrogen took over, she felt everything more acutely. There were good emotions, like confidence in who she was, but then there were the bad as well. Doubt, loneliness, uncertainty, it was all so overwhelming. Understandably, she often felt conflicted. On the one hand, she was finally embracing who she truly was. But on the other hand, she was still in prison, where she'd likely remain for her entire 35-year sentence. That was a dim prospect. After appeals against her conviction failed, Chelsea's hope slowly seeped out of her. By mid-2016, the 28-year-old had reached a breaking point. She felt so depressed and isolated that she attempted suicide again. The guards found her in her cell, breathing but unresponsive, and rushed her to the hospital. As a result of this suicide attempt, Chelsea was given 2 weeks in solitary. Then, once she was back in her cell, she tried to hurt herself again. Unfortunately, the vicious cycle seemed primed to continue. It was clear to everyone on Chelsea's team that she was running out of time. If she remained in prison, she wouldn't survive. So in November of 2016, they applied for a presidential commutation. They weren't asking for her to be pardoned. They just wanted her sentence cut short. The team drummed up all the support they could find. They ran a high-profile campaign on Chelsea's behalf, which garnered more than 100,000 signatures on a WhiteHouse.gov petition. She also got letters of support from former whistleblowers, celebrities, and LGBTQ+ organizations. It seemed like everyone wanted Chelsea to have a second chance. On the afternoon of January 17, 2017, Chelsea toiled away in the prison workshop when a team of security guards walked into the room. They told her to come with them, and her stomach dropped. She wasn't sure what she'd done, but getting pulled aside like that was never a good sign. When Chelsea asked if she was coming back to the workshop and they said no, she figured she was headed for another stint in solitary. Instead, they brought her to the special housing unit. She braced herself for whatever punishment came next, but then she caught a glimpse of a TV tuned to the news in the common area. On the screen was the announcement. Her sentence had been commuted. Chelsea couldn't believe her eyes. It seemed too good to be true, but somehow it was real. 4 months later, it was official. On the morning of May 17th, 29-year-old Chelsea walked out the front gates of Fort Leavenworth and never looked back. 7 years after her conviction, she was a free woman. For many, Chelsea Manning is a martyr who was unjustly punished. But for plenty of others, she's a traitor who deserved her prison sentence. She may have shed light on wrongdoing, but she did it by endangering people's lives. The thing is, both these views can be true at the same time. Chelsea's story isn't black and white. It's entirely shades of gray. At times, she didn't see it that way, but when we take a step back, it feels safe to say that Chelsea herself did things that were both right and wrong. That doesn't make her a bad person, it just makes her human. Ultimately, she fought for what she believed in, and she didn't let anyone stop her, no matter the cost. Thanks again for tuning in to Female Criminals. We'll be back next week with a new episode. For more information on Chelsea Manning, amongst the many sources we used, we found Matthew Scherr's New York Times profile, The Long, Lonely Road of Chelsea Manning, and Denver Nick's book, Private, extremely helpful to our research. You can find all episodes of Female Criminals and all other Spotify originals from Parcast for free on Spotify. We'll see you next time. Female Criminals is a Spotify original from Parcast. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Michael Motion, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Trent Williamson, Carly Madden, and Aaron Larson. This episode of Female Criminals was written by Alex Burns and edited by Joel Callen, fact-checking by Haley Milliken, and research by Mickey Taylor and Chelsea Wood. I'm Vanessa Richardson.
Hi, it's Carter, here to remind you that a very special evening with Crime Junkies Ashley Flowers and Parcast founder Max Cutler is just days away. It's an event celebrating the release of Parcast's first book, Cults, and you can be a part of it virtually on Spotify Live or in person. The evening will take place in Los Angeles on July 13th and feature discussions about the book, a live Q&A, and more. Plus, all ticket sales up to $125,000 will be matched by Max Cutler and donated to Season of Justice, a nonprofit founded by Ashley Flowers that provides financial resources to help solve cold cases and support families impacted by unsolved violent crimes. This has all the makings of being the true crime event of the year, so don't miss out. Register for your spot today at parcast.com/cults. All attendees will receive a special signed copy of Parcast's new book, Cults. That's parcast.com/cults to sign up today.